LegalizeFreedom.com. Why are we here? Where do we come from? Where are we going? From the nature of reality to the future of humanity. Beyond politics, poverty, and war. LegalizeFreedom.com.
Greetings and welcome once again to LegalizeFreedom.com. I'm your host Greg Moffat, and today we present part two of our interview with Courtney Brown, discussing the Farsight Institute's latest project, Remote Viewing Cydonia Mars. The interview resumes as we continue to discuss mainstream media manipulation and the suppression of information and ideas.
Well, I think people will be saying you guys have deviated somewhat from the Martian project, and that's fine, but I hope they'll bear with us. And view this as part of a continuum of ideas, you know, about humanity and about consciousness. And
well, it really is. It really is, Greg. The reason I went off on that sort of that tangent was because the problems that you had with repressing the information about the pedophilia thing is actually very similar to the problems we're having worldwide with respect to the repression, especially in the United States, with the repression of the understanding of extraterrestrial life and the existence of remote viewing. You may think they're totally different things, but they're actually very similar. You have ideas that are very set, patterned beliefs that have to change. And the process for changing those beliefs is the same, whether you're dealing with a pedophilia scandal or you're dealing with the open recognition of remote viewing and extraterrestrial life. You're talking about the changing of ideas. And in all of those cases, you had physical horror stories that result from patterned beliefs that were crazy. So you can say, well, a lot of people were hurt with the pedophilia stuff. Well, a lot of people have been hurt with regard to the extraterrestrial life type stuff as well. There's been a lot of the cover-up issues are not going to be easy for society to face, because once you're talking about extraterrestrial life being acknowledged on Mars, everyone's going to be asking the same thing. So, like, you've known this for how long? And, like, what have you been telling us? And what have you been doing to people who were trying to talk about this? And it goes on and on and on. So the authorities, part of the things that the authorities have been doing in waiting it out is partially they've been waiting for the people who were given the orders to repress this information to retire and die off. There's an issue there.
Yeah, I mean, you can attempt to repress any and all human fundamental urges, but sexuality is one that it's like playing with fire. And I'm a firm believer that that's where you mentioned Saudi Arabia, you mentioned the Catholic Church. That suppression of sexual energy can be devastating individually and collectively. And it reminds me of the sci-fi film. I often think about this when I think about mind manifesting something when it's in trouble. The sci-fi film Forbidden Planet. And
oh, yeah.
These guys arrive on this planet and there's Altair 5, I think it's called, and there's a father there living with his daughter.
Yeah.
And their relationship is troubled. And it's got nothing to do with sex whatsoever, but there's an issue between them and they're being plagued by this monster that appears and attacks their compound and everything else. And The astronauts who arrive are battling it and trying to deal with it. And it turns out that this monster is a physical manifestation of the negativity between the people on the planet. And that's the analogy I would use for sexual repression, is that you cannot contain it. It will get out somehow. And if you try and contain it too long, it will blow up.
Yeah, there's a huge issue with that. You know, we have found out that the best remote viewers are artists, people who have the ability to describe things that they're perceiving. You can perceive anything, but you know, we don't yet have the technology to put wires up to people's heads and get pictures of what those internal images are. So they have to be able to draw and describe clearly what they're perceiving. So artists have sort of an intellectual capability of abstraction. They can see something and then represent that in painting and drawing and so on. But they also have the skills of being able to draw. So that's very important. So I'm heavily involved in the artist community. I'm an artist myself. Joe McMonagle, one of the great military remote viewers, he was an artist. Ingo Swan, actually Joe still is an artist. Ingo Swan, he's died, he's dead, the late Ingo Swan. He was one of the great pioneers in early procedures, CRV procedures for remote viewing. He was an artist. He lived in New York. Dad Smith in Britain, out in Bath, England, he is a very, very good graphic artist. And Dick Allgaier he was a celebrity newscaster for like 30 years in Hawaii. He was like the face of the news for 30 years in Hawaii. And he just happens to be able to be very skilled in drawing and so on. So, you know, art is a fundamental component to it. And so in the artist community, sensuality is huge. Sexuality is huge. And we're always running into these issues of what can be shown and what can't be shown. Because like I'm in front of a nude, one or more nude models, 5-6 hours a week, drawing, sketching, things like that. And so nudity is like nothing to me. I mean, it's like I'm standing, staring at literally every pore of nude models as I'm trying to get all the shapes down and so on, together with other artists. And I'm also a photographer and a digital illustrator, and we deal with nudity all the time. But you have these things that you have these really great works of art you can't show on like YouTube. The nipples have to be covered, and Facebook has similar things you can't show genitalia. I mean, you can have open genitalia shown on the wall of on the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel, but you can't put it on YouTube. So we are just in a very sort of odd society where sensuality and sexuality is severely repressed. Well, they take that and extend it to extraterrestrial life and remote viewing and things like that, and you get the exact same phenomena. Certain things just are not open to certain venues. So I cannot show photography that has nipples on it, or a digital illustration that has nipples on it and so on like that on YouTube and so on, or Facebook. But on the other hand, I can't talk about this subject of remote viewing as a real subject, or extraterrestrial life as a real subject, as a university professor. I don't even try, because, you know, the thing is I'm hired to teach courses like statistics and things like that. That's my job at the university. I'm a mathematician and I work in a social science program, and I don't do any remote viewing research there. So, you know, I do what I'm supposed to do at the university, which is to teach, you know, what they hired me to do, which is methodological stuff and things like that. However, in no university worldwide do you have the subjects of remote viewing or extraterrestrial life taught. And that's bonkers. I mean, it's just crazy. I mean, we have very clear indications of UFO activity, extraterrestrial activity here on Earth, and all of it is squelched. For example, the Phoenix Lights, that was a group of extraterrestrial spacecraft that flew in formation over 5 states. They eventually settled in over Phoenix, and it was seen by hundreds of thousands of people that were all staring up in the sky, including the governor, Fief Symington, of Arizona. Now, these are not lights. Some of them were very low, and they saw the underbellies of the ships that blocked out all the stars. I mean, you could see you could see the bottoms of the ships. They were right over, you know, like a couple hundred feet over your head. They were huge. They were the biggest things that you could see. Now, the mainstream media completely squelched all that. There was nothing about it. And then 6 months after the Phoenix Lights, the military sent out a flight lieutenant, a pilot, who gave one brief press conference, just a statement saying, "Oh, that, That was just some flares we threw up. We just threw up some flares and that was it. And the mainstream media publicized that. I mean, they said it was like they were silent for the whole thing of things that hundreds of thousands of people saw. But when it came to one guy coming out and saying that was just some flares, it was in all the major papers, all the major TV news. that was finally resolved. So you can see that there was a tremendous amount of pressure, tension in the psyche, the collective psyche of the mass of people, especially the establishment. And they were basically waiting for the government to come up with some story that they could shoot out that would dismiss all that stuff. And then the most ridiculous story that you can imagine, oh, they were just some flares who dropped. That was given. That was more than enough. And they publicized it all over the place. So you can see that there's a real tension in society itself. It's not like there are evil guys at the top controlling the masses. The masses themselves have their issues of what they're allowing themselves to perceive. So we don't have anybody in the universities talking about the Phoenix Lights, even though there was, you know, enormous numbers of witnesses, including the governor himself. You can't even discuss that in any major university. You can't even bring up the issue of saying, look, why don't we just get over this and talk about the extraterrestrials? I mean, like everybody saw it. So it's like we're in a real interesting problem. So how do you get out of this problem? Do you get it by having demonstrations on university levels? It has nothing to do with that. You get out of that problem by slowly sliding the thoughts of the masses in another direction. And that's what we're doing. That's what you're doing. That's what you're helping, Greg, by having this interview here. By the way, again, if I can ask people, we are a nonprofit. We do not have any ways of advertising. So if you can, just sign up for our free newsletter. That's the only way we have to tell people what we're doing. We come up with regular projects. We have another one coming out in a month and a half, which is to die for. It's going to be really interesting. And we have new things about our current projects that we release once a week in our newsletter. And if you just go to our website, www.farsight, like seeing far, farsight.org, at the top of the navigation bar, it says, sign up for our free newsletter. Just click on that, put your email address in. We never give out our email addresses for any reason whatsoever to anybody. And we only use them for the newsletter, so there's no worries about spam. And it's free. So, that's, if you want to know what we're doing and the latest, if you want to be ahead of the curve and not wait for, you know, the mainstream to eventually acknowledge this stuff, sign up for the free newsletter and sort of be on track.
With regard to, you know, they are doing this and they are doing that and stuff's being withheld, in terms of projection and collective human consciousness, is the idea of a Watiko. For example, George Bush, the idiot boy Bush, what a bad president. As far as I'm concerned, he was a projection of collective consciousness. You know, that's what the collective were thinking. So that's what manifested, you know.
Yeah, actually, you're with that language that you just used. You're referencing the concert and the statements that were made in Britain by the Dixie Chicks. The lead singer of the Dixie Chicks made the comment in Britain saying, by the way, I know you guys are really upset about what our nation is doing, but our president is doing in the Middle East and so on. But we're sort of embarrassed that he came from Texas as well. He's just the idiot kid. So, but that was, they were talking about George Bush, Jr., the second George Bush. Just for your own listeners, that was a very clever reference that you did, but you should know that that was a very interesting, comment that sparked that whole thing, and that was done by during a Dixie Chicks concert. By the way, that Dixie Chicks comment that was made by the lead singer Natalie Maines in Britain, that had enormous implications. Talk about rigidity of thought in the United States, and the Dixie Chicks were banned from country music in the South, which is basically the southern thing in the United States. It's national and worldwide, but it's headquartered in the southern states in the United States. And the disc jockeys, the radio people in country radio basically banned them. They wouldn't play their records anymore. And they had scenes where, like, bulldozers rolled over the Dixie Chicks albums. I mean, there were death threats against the Dixie Chicks, Natalie Maines and others. And they basically had to leave country music, despite the fact that they were really the hit group and among female groups in country music. And they were no longer welcome in Nashville and the Country Music Awards and so on. And the response to that was that Hollywood adopted them. So what happened is the year after that, they won 9 Grammys. 9 Grammys. Basically, Hollywood said, well, then you're one of us. And so instead of getting country awards, they got 9 Grammys. And so they basically shifted from the Nashville crowd, Nashville audience, to the mainstream, sort of non-Nashville, with their country sound still. But it really disrupted them a lot. But they were a good example of what happens when you take thought that is in discord with the dominant patterned belief system, and you throw that thought into it. Now, if you bring it up, you know, what we look at is the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq were really disasters. I mean, the Iraq war was a real disaster. There was no reason for us to go into Iraq. The wars are still going on. They're not ending. They're not on front page anymore, but the war in Afghanistan is still blazing just like before. And no end in sight. And the turmoil in the Middle East and Iraq is, you know, nowhere in sight. And so we're really in a situation where we can say, well, what did we get out of that war? And now with the 9/11 disclosures that are slowly coming out, there's a huge number of architects and engineers, like thousands, who have signed petitions saying the official story of what was told to us about the collapse of those buildings, especially Building 7 at the World Trade Center, is just bogus. It's just not correct. That's not what happened. That was controlled demolition that brought down Building 7. Now there's good evidence of controlled demolition being involved in the other ones. And there's really not much dispute about Building 7, which is the other building in the World Trade Center that was brought down. And that was clearly a controlled demolition. And, you know, the governments had not confessed anything about that. But to bring down a building like that while the World Trade Center, while the Twin Towers were on fire and collapsing, is impossible. You have to set those charges weeks in advance, and everything has to be very delicately done. So there's all types of questions that have been raised about that. And the bombing of the Pentagon, for example, to say that was a jumbo jet that did that, there's like thousands of pilots that have signed petitions saying you can't do that with a jumbo jet. Whatever that thing was, it flew at treetop level, like 300-400 feet above the ground. And then immediately after getting over the Pentagon grounds, and getting past the trees, it immediately dived down and leveled out at 4 feet over the ground, flew level over the grounds of the Pentagon, and crashed horizontally into the Pentagon. And the pilots, I'm a pilot myself, but the major pilots organizations that have signed on, and they've said, I don't care if you're Tom Cruise in a Top Gun, nobody could fly a jet like that. Those big lumbering jumbo jets can't do that type of aerobatics. And then you look at the actual impact in the Pentagon. It's too small of a hole for a jumbo jet. And whatever did hit the Pentagon had no wings. There's no wing marks. There's no wings. There's no wings in the wreckage. There's no wings in whatever happened. And last anyone heard, jumbo jets have wings. So, I mean, there's all types of real questions about what happened. So our project, the 9/11 project, which many of your listeners may want to visit if they haven't visited before. I know you interviewed me about that. But that was a really amazing project, and we were definitely allowed to publicize that. We could have been shut down in a second. So there is a huge element within the intelligence community and the government that is that is really ticked off at what happened with the 9/11 stuff. And the only way we could have been allowed to do that, to have those full revelations of the backstory of what really happened in 9/11, according to those remote viewing data, is because somebody, you know, a large segment in the intelligence community and elsewhere wanted it out. And we're protected. We were protected to be able to publish that because they could have stopped it in a second. So yeah, there's the stuff with extraterrestrial life and the Cydonia stuff, the civilization that used to occur on, that used to be on Mars. It's exactly the same type of situation. We're allowed to publish this because there are people very high up, large elements in the military, the intelligence community, that are battling. There's a war going on behind the scenes about people from between people who don't want this stuff out and people who do want it. And, you know, the people who do want it are clearing the way to allow us to keep functioning. So when you and your listeners actually listen to our stuff and watch the stuff, and we show it all on video, live on video, so that you don't have to believe anything. You can see it. We're one, if there's one thing we do believe in, and that's the absence of secrets. So you don't have to have faith or trust anything. You can just watch the whole thing yourself and see the viewers actually collect this data. And it's, we were worried about whether the audience would be able to do it, but it turned out that the audience has been finding that these videos that we have been producing are really gripping. They're on the edge of their seat type gripping. And we discovered that really with the 9/11 project. We said, will people be able to sit through two videos that are sort of long, like close to 2 hours each? We have not heard a single complaint about people saying they were boring. It was like they were like, they were like watching the biggest mystery of the planet sort of unroll right before their eyes on the edge of the seat every minute. So many times I've heard that people said, I'll watch the first one, and then in a few days I'll watch the second one. And they said they couldn't stop. They just kept going through the night because they just couldn't stop.
Yeah, exactly.
And so the Cydonia video is very similar. It's like when you realize that the data you're watching are like live, and you're watching them, and the whole backstory of how the Martians lived, what they looked like, what their buildings were like, how they were so much like us, and you see it described in such explicit detail, and then you go, then you see like what's there now, the ruins, and you see the viewers sort of piece it together, and it's all matching with the photographs that you have in front of you. It's really a really very interesting process to watch. And anyway, that's what we're dealing with our new project, the Cydonia, remote viewing Cydonia Mars. I might mention also, Greg, what the next project is going to be. We've actually done the remote viewing. It's this Cydonia Mars thing is actually part one of a three-part thing on extraterrestrials. And the reason it happened that way is because our remote viewers were so adamant about not doing remote viewing with extraterrestrial targets. When I finally got it to the point where I was going to do it anyway, I stuck three separate incidents, three separate targets in, three separate, you know, elements in at the same time with the same project, fearing that they might quit on me if I did it a second, if I did it again. So I said, okay, if I have my one shot at this, I'm going to get three big ones. And the next one is a large facility that's on Iapetus, at the moon of Saturn. We have a really good photograph of it from care of NASA. And I always wondered, what is that thing? And so we did remote viewing, and the remote viewers did an unbelievable job with that. And that's going to be coming out in about a month and a half, 2 months. And, but for right now, we're dealing with the Cydonia thing, but it's, you'll see just equally sort of eye popping stuff when you get to the next one.
Yeah. Well, we'll round off, Courtney, with a couple of points about the Cydonia project. But just before I get to those, a couple of more general thoughts about alien life. And you mentioned earlier about, the mainstream media and their treatment of news stories and the Phoenix Lights you mentioned. On one hand, you've got a big public project like SETI, you know, the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And that's accepted. And if there's any talk about UFO sightings that turn out to be bogus, everyone seems quite comfortable with that. But the strange thing is when you have something that might suggest that there might be a reality to some of this, that gets all suppressed. So it's strange that something like SETI, that means we're looking out there to see if there is anything. But it's almost like, God forbid we find anything, because we must suppress that, you know?
My personal opinion is that that is a huge smokescreen, that has nothing to do with anything serious, and that is actually part of a big project. I believe that there are mainstream scientists, astronomers working on the SETI program, and they're trying to think of it as a credible thing. But I think it's being funded. I think they have, my personal view is that they have their own issues, and that, you know, my personal view is that the whole thing is being, any funding that's coming to them is oriented around keeping this thing in the, and sort of the public circus of, we have not yet discovered any evidence of extraterrestrial life. It's, you know, I mean, there is no ambiguity that the government has extremely detailed information about the extraterrestrials, both what's been going on in our solar system as well as elsewhere. But what is a problem, and it confuses everything, is that there's such a suppression of the information that it fools academics as well. For example, I am the only academic on the entire planet that talks about remote viewing as it's done using the military or military derived procedures. Now, I do not talk about it at the university, but nonetheless, I am a tenured professor at a major university, and I'm the only guy on the whole planet that's doing this. Now, that tells you something, that there's a huge resistance. Now, no one's laughing anymore, but someone's got to write a book about the mass psychology of ideas and the resistance to that stuff. So there's no ambiguity in that the government is very well aware of the extraterrestrials and their activity. So then you say, well, what is this SETI stuff all about? That, in my view, the whole issue is, it's a collaboration between deluded scientists who are trying to think that, you know, they're going to be the ones to discover some type of radio signal, and governmental people who say this sort of fits into our agenda of making the public think that we don't know about the extraterrestrials. So they're searching for radio signals in certain radio bands. Now, look, we as a society don't use any of the frequencies that the SETI people are studying. Like when we broadcast television and radio, we don't use those frequencies. So they're studying certain frequencies that they think would be detectable, with interstellar transmissions, if someone was trying to get to us in these certain high frequencies. And I'm saying, well, if we don't use those frequencies, why the heck do you think other people would use those frequencies? And secondly, why do you think they'd use radio of all things to transmit to us? And what about the flying saucers and UFOs that were seen by hundreds of thousands of people right over your head? Why are you trying to do this with these radio signals? So I don't take the SETI thing at all seriously. Look at it this way, Greg. NASA recently closed down the entire U.S. manned space flight program. We don't send people to space anymore. Now, just think about that. Does that sound reasonable to you, that the U.S. government would take decades of research into sending people into space and then just say, well, that was fun, guys. Let's wipe our hands of that and go on to something else. That was fun. Okay, what are we doing now? And then go off and do something else. I mean, it's just crazy. It's absurd. They would never lose that investment and have to reinvest that whole thing on how to do that stuff.
Didn't Obama say, well, kind of, we can't really afford this, but in any case, we've already been to the moon. You know, we've been there, done that, bought the t-shirt.
That's the public face of that stuff. The reality is, it's with all of the extraterrestrial contacts that they have, they undoubtedly have other means of getting people into space. And they don't want to talk about that, because if you did talk about that, that opens up the whole ball of wax. But the idea, people should just put two and two together. Is it in the slightest bit reasonable that we should stop our entire manned spaceflight program? It just became too much of an expense to do, given the fact that it wasn't needed anymore. Then you say, well, the U.S. broke. Well, okay, now look, Greg, let's deal with that. Do they have the money if they really wanted to do that? Of course they have the money. For example, the U.S. Defense Department, military spending in the United States. If you take our spending, that what we do in the United States, our budget for military spending is bigger than the total military budget for all other countries on the entire planet Earth combined. We have plenty of money.
Now, but also, it's not even about money. I'll just throw this thought in. It's about resources.
Yeah.
What you can and cannot do has got nothing to do with cash, because that's an illusion anyway.
Yeah. I mean, if they really thought that was a high priority to send chemical rockets up into space to put people up there, they would be doing it. They obviously don't think that's of great value, and they thought they could save the cash. So they said, let's just stop doing that. They obviously, it's at the point now where they, where, you know, it just became a laughing issue of, you know, sending these rockets up with people. So they just sort of stopped it, and they said, let's, you know, the public's, we've got the public so wrapped around our fingers, they'll believe any story we say. We'll just say we're tired of sending people up and can't afford it anymore and so on. They obviously have some other way to get people up. And, you know, the UFOs obviously don't use chemical rockets to propel themselves. They obviously have some other means of doing it, using a different level of physics. But you know that that exists anyway, because the remote viewing phenomenon itself deals with a different level of physics that you're not taught at the university. So, you know, there's all sorts of information that we don't have exposed to the public. But that's what the Farsight Institute is about. We're involved in getting this information out so that slowly the populace can be more acclimatized to these new ideas. And then collectively as a society, we can slide over to a better framework where we should be. I really think this is really important, because not only are we studying about new and interesting things like Martian civilizations, but we're learning from the Martian civilization so that our society, with these new ideas, learning from the past, can avoid the problems of whatever happened out there to end life on Mars. I mean, there is still some life on Mars, but, you know, you're talking about a few bases, underground bases with some operatives, you know, extraterrestrials working there. We may even have some humans from Earth that are there, that have got there through our, you know, our own means of getting there. I mean, we don't really know what. I have purposely not done a major project on Area 51. That's one I really honestly don't think we're going to do, because, you know, if you go into what sort of the military has, well, that's their territory. We've never really gone into, like, the 9/11 thing was something that was orchestrated by political people and a small wing of the military, but very small. And Area 51, that's like going right into the heart of the military, stuff. There's no reason for us to go there, where it's much more interesting places. We might as well find out about what the extraterrestrials are doing rather than going into the U.S. military and finding out, what crashed spaceships they have in Area 51. And so on. So you can assume that some of the UFOs that have been sighted are, in fact, being flown by U.S. military personnel from ships that are either built from scratch using reverse engineered technology, or repaired ships that are crashed ET ships, for example, in Area 51, where they put them back together. You can assume that some of those, not all of them, but some of them are flown by us. So the question is, what else do they do with those ships? Do they just test fly them, or do they use any operationally to get to Mars to have a facility up there? So we don't really know. We know that there's some bases on Mars underground. All of them are underground, buried. But we don't know how extensive this is, whether it's humans up there or whether it's just other extraterrestrials that have places up there. Mm. You can assume that there's a similar stuff on the moon, similar stuff on Mars. And, well, our next project shows something that used to exist, it's no longer habitable, but used to exist on Iapetus. That is really interesting what they used it for.
Just before I forget, it's just one general thought about alien or extraterrestrial life. A lot of people, obviously, we've discussed sightings and how this might react with our physical reality. But I was reading recently about some experiments with psychoactive psychedelic substances. One in particular, DMT, a dimethyltryptamine, and people can read up about this. It's something that occurs in almost all life on the planet, and in human beings as well. We generate it. Some people say it's connected to the pineal gland, but. Yeah. Thinking about that, and reading about these experiments and some of the experiences that the subjects were having when they were injected with DMT, very often they would interact with what they would characterize as entities. And yeah. in a way that they considered to be more real than real. And sometimes the experiences were terrifying. Sometimes it was the most profoundly spiritual thing that ever happened to them. Now, consider that, and then consider that 95%-something of the universe is lost to dark matter. That's the most of the universe that we don't know what it is. We don't know where it is. We can't measure it. Scientists only infer its existence because of perceived effects on the remaining 4%. So most of the universe is invisible to us. So if we put the DMT idea together with the invisibility of most of the universe, who knows what could be out there in all that?
Well, actually, Gregory, it's an interesting point because the military to this day actually does experiment with things like that. They push the limits for all that type of stuff, both technologically, machines, but also chemicals. And that actually is part of their research program to investigate. They like to use these things for military reasons. They like to use these things operationally to, you know, I've even heard some stories of them using these things operationally in the field. So remote viewers are being used to guide certain subjects, people like soldiers, certain soldiers that are, the whole, there's a training that goes involved with this that's chemically enhanced to sort of know if there is enemy to the left or to the right. So if there's an ambush to the left, sort of a pulse is given out to the soldiers, to a certain well-trained soldier leader to say, go to the right. So they're actually using it with chemical stuff all the time. That's my understanding. However, that's very opposite what we believe and do here at the Farsight Institute. We're very much in the opposite direction of wanting to keep this totally a natural thing. When you deal with drugs, it's like having your car and throwing a monkey wrench right into the middle of the engine. You'll get all types of things happen. You'll get an explosion. You'll get all types of sounds coming out. And you'll say, wow, look at that. So throwing chemicals into the physiology, into the system, will give you some reactions and you'll get some things, whether it's LSD or marijuana or anything, or the substances you were talking about, you'll get some reaction, but you're wrecking the car. You're doing stuff to the body that's not healthy. What we like to do is show that under optimal conditions, with a clean nervous system that's not screwed up with any types of psychoactive drugs, that a well-trained person can do these things. And the level of perceptions we have are unsurpassed by anybody else, meaning the quality of the remote viewing is extraordinary, and you get control. When you have drugs entered into the system, you have the lack of control. You get experiences, but you're not controlling the experiences. So in order for remote viewing to do really well, it really requires a drug-free environment, a drug-free person. So for people who want to do remote viewing, the best thing advice I can give you is, I don't care if it's legal in Colorado or California or whatever, stay off pot, stay off drugs, don't have any psychoactive stuff.
That makes total sense with a discipline like remote viewing. I only mentioned the DMT stuff because that was a controlled experiment. The case I'm thinking about with Dr. Rick Strassman, who had to be on with me shortly to talk about this, only because DMT itself is naturally produced in our bodies, and also it can spontaneously produce in large quantities. So people could have these experiences with entities without having any intervention from outside, if you see what I mean. But yeah, of course.
Yeah, no, I agree with you totally. And it's a very interesting discussion. And in fact, the military does use stuff like this. So it's perfectly legitimate, and it's a very important discussion, and it's a very important element. I just want people that are listening, they put two and two together and come up with five. So I want it to be very clear to people that it's easy and fast and cheap to have psychic experiences that are enhanced by chemicals, but you're wrecking the car. I mean, don't interpret what we're talking about to mean go out and use drugs. These great remote viewers do the opposite.
thinking about the way that life on Mars, the period that you guys were investigating, seems to have come to an end. You know, I know you mentioned that there may still be traces of it there, but I read an article recently, a speculative one, almost philosophical, to be honest, and it was setting out the idea that perhaps one reason that we haven't, and this again, this is just this author's perspective, one of the reasons that we haven't encountered extraterrestrial life is because advanced civilizations have a tendency to destroy themselves before they can get off planet. Now, I know that idea goes against a lot of your work, but I thought it was an interesting thought because thinking about what happened on Mars and thinking about the direction we're headed in. And then I got to thinking about, you know, people have talked for a long time. I remember when I was growing up and watching The Sky at Night with Sir Patrick Moore, and he was saying Mars really is the best bet for life in our solar system in the past. And then I read about the methane clouds that they've been measuring on Mars. I'm not sure if it's at the North Pole or not. I read an article saying, is this the beginning of life on Mars? And then I got to thinking, you know, a further thought, given the background to the work you've done, is it possible for life to get all but extinguished and then start again? Then we're back to life finds a way. We're back to cataclysms on Earth in the past and on and on.
Well, it's a good question. We know that there is still life on Mars because there's methane in the atmosphere, a lot of it. And that methane cannot come about through geological processes, that quantity of methane. So it's, methane does not stay around very long, so it's continually leaking into the atmosphere. So there's some, it decays. So there's some life on Mars now. Whether that life is plant life or decaying organic matter or some things there now. It's not a lot. Mars is essentially a dead planet, but there is something there. And so, you know, the real question about what we're going to learn from this Martian experience in the past really boils down to how long it's going to take for our society to open up to be able to discuss the whole issue, because there's a tremendous amount we can learn. The idea that all civilizations would die once they got to a sufficiently high level, that's really flawed. It's not scientific thinking at all, because I've heard it before, and you're correct to bring it up. And it is scientists who have sometimes said that or speculated along those lines. But scientists make huge mistakes all the time. The only scientific thing that you can say is that there is a distribution. All of science is based on the understanding that there is a distribution, and that distribution has for everything, and that distribution has a mean, and it has some things that are much higher and such things that are much lower. Thus, you will have there'll be a distribution of survival for civilizations. So it's not that it's a deterministic thing that all civilizations will die off after they achieve a certain level of technology. You'll have a certain number of civilizations, a certain percentage, and a mean, and an average, a proportion, actually, that will do that, that will die off. And apparently that's what happened with Mars, and it may have happened with the planet that was there before we had the asteroid belt. So certain types of societies will in fact follow that exact path, but there will always be a distribution. You'll have other societies that will last, for whatever reasons, the characteristics of those societies will be somewhat different, that will last millions of years, much longer, evolve into something else. And you'll have other societies that won't even make it that far. They won't get to the level of technology. They'll destroy themselves before that. So you'll always have a distribution. That's the only thing that's scientifically defendable. But it is clear that there is a very significant risk of civilizations killing themselves off. And we have to be very serious about that. We have to be very concerned about that, because our planet in particular is very, very vulnerable. Not only is the species, us, that lives on the planet, very volatile emotionally. We feel our emotions quite strongly, and we get angry, and we build, you know, major weapon systems and so on. But also we happen to live on a planet that's that is almost entirely made of a liquid. We live on top of an ocean of liquid lava. That's really not a very stable planet to live on. It's okay for a few thousand years. For the last 3,000 years, it's been stable enough for us to, you know, rebuild our civilization. And here we are today talking on radio and the internet and so on. But if you go 20,000 years out, something's going to happen. There's going to be a coronal mass ejection at some point. And no one is in disagreement with this, whether it's NOAA or NASA. Everyone says there will be a coronal mass ejection eventually that will burp from the sun in our direction, and that will cause severe ripples inside the magnetic core of the Earth, and then the lava will bubble. It'll not necessarily bubble, but ripple. But those ripples will crack the surface and will be in very serious trouble. So this is a very delicate planet to live on. In fact, this actually raises speculatively questions about why we're here in the first place. This is a really good planet for a biological and zoological garden, but it's a terrible planet for a long-term civilization. A long-term civilization needs a million years of uninterrupted peace and quiet to develop. This place is a roller coaster. I mean, you're living on a liquid lake of lava. I mean, it's just crazy to have a long-term civilization that requires, you know, hundreds of thousands of years to develop on a place like this. So the real question is, why are we here? Now this is speculative, Greg. I actually think that we were probably started out as a civilization as refugees from some other place, and that this was a place of last resort. I actually think that's probably how we got here, how we started.
I love it, Courtney. Yeah, given all we've been talking about, you say, now this is speculative, Greg.
No, actually, the issue is speculative because we don't have any solid data for it.
Yeah.
But it's all pointing in the direction of why would intelligent people come to a place like this? And there must have been some reason we came here and we decided to build a civilization here. This is not the planet of choice to do that. So I can only assume that there was something driving people here. And looking at what happens here on Earth, we have all types of problems that cause refugee situations. So maybe that's how it all started. And now here we are, a civilization trying to make a go at it.
I know, when people look around me, you only have to turn on the nightly news, as I want to say, and people look around at all the murder and the mayhem, and sometimes, because the nightly news doesn't report on all the love and all the light. And for me, it's being here isn't some kind of nightmare that I want to be over as quickly as possible. I mean, for me, it's like, you know, what a trip. To be alive on this planet.
Yeah, and actually to be able to talk about these issues that you're doing right now that we're doing right now on your show. It's really exciting to be in a society where all of these things aren't already resolved. So we're on the cutting edge of a civilization that is about to give birth to its future. And this is a fun time to be on a planet that's sort of an exciting place to be, in a galaxy full of life. And I would assume that we're the best show in town in terms of the galaxy right now. I bet a lot of people are watching us. I'm not talking about humans on Earth. I'm talking about people out there in the galaxy. I bet an awful lot of people are looking at this planet, and we're the soap opera of the galaxy right now.
Yeah, I've seen a lot of visions of utopia, and I didn't much like the look of any of them. Just a closing thought. What we've been talking about here in remote viewing is essentially the interface and interaction between, as we understand it, the material and non-material. And
yeah.
You've talked about the potential here to change the world, to transform humanity. I've spoken to you several times over the last couple of years about this. And I speak to a lot of other people who are concerned with the advancement of science and the nexus with spirituality and some kind of reconciliation, a synthesis that can move us forward. How have you felt over the last couple of years, you know, as I say, since we first spoke, about responses you've been getting to your work? Do you feel that you're making progress? You know, how do you feel overall about, you know, where your mission, if you want to call it, is going?
Yeah, there's a progress in two realms. First of all, we seem to be increasingly getting governmental support to allow us to continue. So, because when we did the 9/11 project and now the Cydonia project, no one's interfering with us. No one's and no one's trying to stop us. So we're really very encouraged by the fact that there's positive elements in the government that are trying to help the society move forward and allow us to do that as a assistant to a overall desire to eventually keep, you know, open up things. But we're also encouraged by the audience is growing, and we're clearly getting new people. Now, you're raising a sensitive issue for us. You may not have known that, but you are. And that is the age of our audience. The military program was closed down officially in November of 1995. And of course, things started up again, but that's still not been publicly acknowledged. But the real point is that that generation that was exposed to this project was in the mid-1990s. So here we are quite a ways since then. I mean, you're talking 20 years later. And you're talking a lot of new people, a lot of young people have not been exposed to all of that. So one of the issues is that the people that are most aware of what's been happening with remote viewing have been those people who were around in the 1990s. And we really have a very serious need to expand the audience to younger people. And younger people have their own ways of communicating, their own style of listening. And they're very much into video, and they're very much into music, and they're very much into sort of ways that they like things presented. And the older generation was used to long presentations, like movies and things like that, long presentations where they'd sit through things. Young people think of that as lecturing, as being told, you know, by older people to sit down in one spot and hear this thing. They don't like that. And generally, they like short clips. They get a lot of information, but they like it delivered to them in short packets, and 2, 3, 4, 5 minute packets, and a lot of information condensed into that. That's their style of reference of receiving that. And a lot of older people sort of talk derogatively about that, like low attention span, short attention span, that type of thing. But it's not that. What really is that they have, younger people have a style of receiving information that they prefer. And what we are doing at the Farsight Institute is to try to expand the audience that we have to the younger generations, to the people who are new to all of this, and to make information packageable or acceptable in their format and the way that they like to receive it. So we've started things like we had for 1 year a comic strip that was done by Vic Guiza. We have another comic strip that's being done by myself that Vic is taking a sabbatical from his. And so I'm doing another one. So on our website at farsight.org, we have a comic strip, but we also have a new web series called Transistence, which is a science fiction web series. It's free. We put it up on YouTube. And now we're starting to produce more versions of that are very short, like 2, 3, 4 minutes long, that we hope will go viral within the young community, because they don't need to be lectured to for a couple hours to understand that this is real. They just need a couple minutes of new ideas introduced, and they get it. So we've got a lot of very interesting video ideas that we're working on. We have got really good production value. We have very good production capabilities, and we're really in tune to the types of things that they want. Also, we're into video, and we're also into music, and we're also into art. So we like the sensuality that is very non-Victorian, but very much within the younger people's way of thinking. And so, we're moving along those lines. So that's another reason to sort of keep in touch with what we're doing. We're oriented now around getting new stuff out on a very regular basis that's cool, sexy, hot, and, fills that educational role the way people like to have it, young people like to have it, which is cool, sexy, hot.
Wonderful. Well, Courtney, just to close things off for today, I know you've mentioned the website a couple of times, but do so once again just for people. Also, where they can rent the Cydonia Mars presentation. As you mentioned, that's going to be available on DVD very shortly. And you might even want to throw in a mention again about the next part of this ongoing project.
Yeah, the Cydonia Mars thing is available now as video on demand. You can watch it like today. And it's everything comes, you get to everything through our website at www.farsight.org. That's FARSIGHT.org. Farsight is like seeing far. And it's org because we're a nonprofit. And the when you're there, before you do anything else, please sign up for our free newsletter. It's at the top of the nav bar. Just put your email in. Again, no spam. We send out those emails, those newsletters about once a week. That's the only way we have to let people know what we're doing, because we don't use advertising. And the Cydonia Mars thing is the most recent. The one we're doing next, the remote viewing is already done on it, is a facility that's on Iapetus. And the only thing I'll mention about that is you'll see all of our projects once you go to our website, farsight.org. But the only thing I'll mention about the Iapetus one is, think of Warren Buffett and Bill Gates, two of the richest guys on the planet. Well, expand your understanding to a solar system rather than Earth. And think of somebody who's way richer than Warren Buffett and Bill Gates. And he has the ability with, you know, modern technology for flying places. I mean, we're not dealing with chemical rockets, but we're dealing with UFO type propulsion systems. He has the ability to build a facility anywhere. Probably the most beautiful spot in the entire solar system for a resort, for a spa, for a health spa, for a place to be, for a spiritual retreat, is on Iapetus. You have a beautiful, pristine moon. You have this, the rings of Saturn right over your head. The galaxy clearly visible without atmospheric distortion. It was Saturn right next by. You can't get a more spiritual, deep, profound place to be. That's what happened in Iapetus. This guy built this thing, and we have this whole story of what they used it for, what it is, and we have a picture of it, because, you know, compliments of the Cassini spacecraft that was sent by NASA there. We've got an enhanced version of that picture, so you can see clearly where it is, where the windows are, the whole story. And we have the whole backstory of it, and that's coming out in a month and a half. But before you do that, see our Cydonia project, because that is closer to Earth, that's Mars, and you need to know the whole story of their civilization, how they lived, how close they were to us, how much they are like us. I like to call them us when we were there. And a lot of those Martians apparently migrated here. I mean, obviously remote viewing shows that we are more than our physical bodies. So the question is, when our physical bodies drop off, when we die of old age, what do we do? Do we just hang around and eat peach cobbler in heaven, or are we to go someplace? Well, a lot of the Martians went somewhere, and the most obvious place for them to go was to a nearby planet, and they were born here. And so we are them. And so I like to think of Martians as us when we were there. And so when you're looking at the project for Cydonia, what we're looking at is what we were doing there. And we really want to know what we were doing there so that we learn from our mistakes and we don't do those things here.
Well, I think I'm going to have to burn my copy of War of the Worlds given all this. Well, fascinating as always, Courtney, and thank you so much for joining us once again on LegalizeFreedom.com.
It's my pleasure, and thanks so much for inviting me again, Greg.
Well, folks, that's it for another week. As ever, thank you so much for listening. If you enjoyed the show, check out the website, which is LegalizeFreedom.com. That's Legalize-Freedom.com, where you'll find an archive of programs offering alternative views on a wide range of topics, including politics and economics, energy and environment, culture, spirituality, history, and the nature of reality. You can also browse and buy a range of publications from our guests, and if you're feeling generous, make a donation to help keep the site up and running. Based on current audience numbers, if everyone who tuned in donated just 5 pence per show, that's about 8 cents US, this could become a full-time, fully funded operation, offering more and more often. During October 2014, over 50,000 of you streamed or downloaded at least one show. Total donations were £7, which currently converts to about $11 US. Whether you listen, donate, or do both, I greatly appreciate your support. Until next time, I'm Greg Moffat, and you've been listening to LegalizeFreedom.com.